Thank you for your practice. So we'll open the floor if anyone has any questions or comments about your meditation experience here tonight or about the practice in general. The floor is open for a little while for that. Yeah, sure.
I was thinking about this while I was meditating, which, so have you gotten to the point where when you're breathing, you can do it without, like, focusing on your breath? Or do you still concentrate on
your breath?
Is your mind kind of just...
Tell me more what you mean.
Like, can you ever get to the point where you're meditating almost like a normal life, don't think about how you're breathing?
So, like, where you don't get as caught up in thoughts and all of that stuff, and then you feel like you're just naturally more connected to the breath? Is that what you mean?
Or can you use something else besides the breath?
Oh, sure. I got you. Okay, I get what you're asking. Yeah. So, yeah, I wouldn't even really say whether you get to the point of, but just that you can use a lot of different objects for your... anchor, you know, in meditation. You can use sound, just natural sound of what the sounds that you're hearing of the air conditioning or sounds, cars coming by. You can use the feeling, the sensation of breathing, which we use oftentimes. You can use the feeling or the sensation of just your butt against the chair, the weight of the body, sense of gravity. And so, you know, what I like to do is I like to, throughout my day, kind of check in with the body, some type of embodied awareness, whether it's the breath or whether it's sound or whether it's the feeling, the weight of my body is just kind of checking in from time to time to get more of a sense of some groundedness or an anchor, you know, because what we tend to do is we tend to spin off into all of the things, the to-do mind is what I call it. And so... you know, so it's always a practice, and it's always such a simple, ordinary practice, and it's always like, you know, my teacher always says, you never graduate from the breath. You never really graduate from the body, the first foundation of mindfulness, that it's always relevant. Yeah. Thank you.
Tonight I have to admit, at first, the heating system was a distraction.
Uh-huh.
I was trying to focus on my breath, and this thing was so loud.
Right.
And then finally I kind of relaxed into it and let it become part of the whole rhythm also, and then it actually changed to be help instead of a distraction.
Yeah, yeah, awesome. Yeah, that's great. Did you have something? Yeah, sure. Sure.
Not allowing your mind to go to negative places. I guess I was kind of, just tonight I was thinking about that, how, you know, a lot of what I was doing to was just to let the mind be the mind and let the thoughts come as they will naturally. I don't know. I guess I just kind of feel a little mixed up about that right now.
Yeah. Right, right. I follow, yeah. That's such a great inquiry, you know, and it's a great thing to contemplate. And it's really like, you know, it's first of all, it's what I'm kind of going to talk about a little bit tonight. But, you know, it's always that type of dynamic of do I accept, you know, or allow or observe the mind and its natural tendency, or do I change my... You know, so it's the acceptance change thing. It's like, what do I allow and what do I actually shift my attention from? And it's always both and, you know, it's always, and so it's very tricky in that way where it's like, you know, we are being gentle and kind and, patient observers of the mind. and at the same time, kind of the parent of the mind, or the part of the mind that says, you know what, enough of that right now, you know, cut it out, and come back, you know, let that, you gotta stop, that thought's not really helpful right now, you know, and so it's one of those things. Thank you for that comment, always relevant. And tonight I wanted to talk for the topic, I wanted to talk about mindfulness of thoughts, attitudes, and moods. I think the important place to start when you're talking about mindfulness of the mind is just in recognizing that oftentimes the mind gets a bad rep in meditation groups, and even some Buddhist groups. We sometimes have this tendency to think about that our goal or our aim or the purpose of practice in some sense is to get rid of the mind. You know, I will even admit myself, when I came to Against the Stream, I primarily came because I was interested in meditation. I was also interested and pretty open, having been atheistic/agnostic person a lot of my life. I was interested in Buddhist practice a little bit, but mostly I was interested in meditation because I had racing thoughts. I had anxiety, and what I heard that meditation really helped, it really helps to calm and curb anxiety. You know, and so in some sense, what we are trying to do is we're trying to, what you could call, abandon unskillful thought. So we are trying to develop some ability to ignore the mind or to break the addiction to the thinking mind. You know, we tend to really spend most of our time focused on the thought world. And a lot of that, a lot of those thoughts that we're focused on is what in psychology they call representational thinking. So it's thoughts about things that represent other things, like future and past, right? What's going to happen, what could happen, what's happening tomorrow or next week, or the, you know, what did just happen, what could I have said or should I have said. So we spend a lot of time in this landscape, you know, and so we want to develop some of an ability to be able to break the addiction of the mind and to come into an embodied awareness, while at the same time we want to also have a really realistic attitude and understanding that we're not going to get rid of the mind. If we could, none of us would need to fucking meditate, right? It'd be pretty sweet. You say, hey, all right, mind, you chill out in the parking lot. I'm going to come in and meditate for 30 minutes. I'll meet you out there in an hour and a half, right? But unfortunately, we can't do it. And so we need to develop a relationship to the mind and a skillful and kind relationship, knowing that, you know, the mind's not so personal, that its job, it gets paid to think, and so that's what it does. My view is that the awakened mind is not a mind free from defilements. We'll talk about what defilements are, but unskillful states, you could say. So I believe that the awakened mind's not a mind free from defilements, but instead a mind that sees a defilement for what it is and knows how to respond to it. The Buddha, during his life, he was constantly visited by someone called Mara. And Mara was, you know, the demonic figure in Buddhism. But it's very representational of the critic of the mind, the self-critic, the inner judge, you know, the pesky kind of shitty mind that follows us around a lot of the time. And so after the Buddha's awakening, something really interesting throughout the discourses is that Mara never stopped visiting the Buddha. You know, he would check in from time to time and be like, hey man, just want to make sure you're still, you know, fully awake and all that. You know, I want to be able to you know, check in with you, see what's up, how's it going? And so Mara would continue to visit the Buddha, this critical mind, the inner judge, the, you know, the anger, the lust, the hatred, the self-obsession would continue to visit the Buddha. And his, the change for him was that what he would say is he would say, I see you, Mara. I see you, Mara. And so what he developed was an ability to be able to recognize these unskillful states of mind and see them for what they really were, not to get rid of them. So we do this. We do this for ourselves with mindfulness. This is something we can investigate and see for ourselves. The more that we practice this very ordinary skill of mindfulness, there's nothing magical about mindfulness meditation, right? It's very ordinary, this capacity, this capability we have to objectively monitor our thoughts, emotions, and feelings. We can see them for what they are. And in doing that, we gain the same skill of being able to watch the mind and its tendencies. Mindfulness originally, you know, mindfulness is a term coined much later after the, you know, Buddhist time, around, I think, the 18th century, and it was laid mostly in a Christian context. And so the actual original word for what mindfulness is a little bit different than what we understand it. It's something called satipatthana. And satipatthana, in Pali Sanskrit, a lot of the words are translated to have many different meanings. So it's not really easy to say, you know, it means this in English or it means that. But it's it kind of gives you an essence of what something may mean. And so satipatthana, in essence, means something like to remember the ground. And so instead of mindfulness, really the essence of what we're doing is something called remembering the ground. We're practicing remembering the ground. And I like to look at this in two ways. The first way is we're remembering the ground. We're remembering what we most often forget, which is this. You know, this is the ground here, right? We're not, we don't exist anywhere else. We exist in this process, in this present moment, present, not moment, but present experience, this verb of the present. And so what we're remembering is we're remembering that the ground in which we stand is actually here. This is it. And so we also remember the ground of the Dharma, or the ground of practices that help us to relinquish mental reactivity and anguish. So what do we mean by this? Well, we remember that we already have some internal skills that we use that help us alleviate our anguish. You know, through practice and through being able to familiarize ourselves with our inner landscape, we know some of the practices and the things that are not very helpful. You know, for example, if I'm driving on my way to work and I'm thinking about the resentment I have against all of my coworkers and I'm character assassinating every single one of them, and, you know, and I'm feeling jealousy and competition and all of this stuff, you know, and then I show up to work, I'm in a pissed off mood, I'm paranoid, I'm judgmental, I'm critical, I don't talk to anyone, I isolate myself, and, you know, so we already know and are able to sometimes stop ourselves from that type of those types of patterns that don't serve us. And so we come back to this ground of the Dharma or the practice, these practices. We start, and I don't like to start because it's not necessarily in sequential order, but we really want to begin by developing and establishing a ground in breath and body awareness. So when we practice mindfulness, we want to develop something called samadhi, which is the ability to collect our awareness, to break the addiction to the mind, and to be able to place our attention where we want it to be placed for a period of time. And this is all subjective, so it doesn't mean, okay, once you place your attention, some teachers would say this, but once you place your attention somewhere for 10 minutes and you do that, then you have graduated from that. But instead, what you're doing is you're just developing a ground in the breath and the body, and you're developing the ability to place your attention there. And then you start to familiarize yourself, you start to actually investigate, like we did tonight, the mind itself. This is kind of, sometimes I talk about the primary and secondary object of meditation. So the primary is the anchor, or the breath, or the body, or sound, and the secondary is anything else that the attention may move to, and then you investigate that, and you see some of the qualities and characteristics it has. Another way to look at this, my teacher doesn't like the primary-secondary thing, is foreground and background. So you develop an ability to put part of your experience in the foreground of your awareness while the other parts fall to the background. So thoughts can kind of arise and pass, and you're not stopping them or cutting them off, but most of your attentions may be in your breath or breathing or in the sound or body. And you develop by being able to investigate these secondary objects or what's in the background, or by being able to sustain your attention with wherever your attention may wander for a period of time, you develop something called sampajanya, or clear comprehension. You're able to recognize certain patterns and certain characteristics of the mind, of your mental attitudes, your feelings. And these patterns aren't anything magical either. They're just, we get more familiar with our attitudes and how our moods affect us and how our emotions affect us and how our mind affects us. And we're more familiar because we're more attentive to those things. Very important, when we investigate the mind or our moods or our attitudes, we do so without interfering, a non-judgmental attitude. This is so important. This is what makes the mindfulness practice more objective. I like to think about this like watching a movie. When I go into a movie theater, you know, hopefully I'm not an objective observer of the film, in the sense of hopefully I'm not just picking apart all of the actor choices they made and, you know, why they made certain scene cuts. And we know some people that do this, right? That's too much mindfulness there for the movie. But, you know, what we want to do is it's kind of that switch. Is the mind has the same compelling narrative as a film would. It has loud sound, and it has a lot of action, and it has you as the character of every story. And so what we want to do is to recognize that you're just watching these parts. You know, you're watching all of the parts of this film kind of come together. And so we start to become more interested in the parts, and not so much as interested in the story itself. So I'm going to read a technical kind of description of what this non-interfering quality, or the non-judgmental quality of mindfulness, is and why we need that. This is by a monastic, a German monk named Anilayo, and he says, this non-interfering quality of sati, this is mindfulness, so this non-interfering quality of mindfulness is required to enable one clearly to observe the building up of reactions and their underlying motives. As soon as one becomes in any way involved in a reaction, the detached observational vantage point is immediately lost. The detached receptivity of mindfulness enables one to step back from the situation at hand and thereby to become an unbiased observer of one's subjective involvement in the entire situation. Maintaining the presence of mindfulness in this way is closely related to the ability to tolerate a high degree of cognitive dissonance, since witnessing one's own shortcomings ordinarily leads to unconscious attempts at reducing the resulting feeling of discomfort by avoiding or even altering the perceived information. And so this is important. You know, mindfulness, what he's basically saying here is we develop a non-judgmental, he says an objective vantage point in being able to observe unbiasedly. I mean, nothing's perfectly unbiased, but to be able to have that intention and to be non-judgmental, what happens is we're able to start to see the underlying patterns of our mind, the motivations of the mind. You know, for example, if I perceive someone as being disrespectful, I usually go 0 to 60 in, you know, a millisecond. I don't necessarily say, oh, I'm hurt. I perceived what they said as disrespectful. Maybe they meant something else. Maybe I should ask for more clarity. Maybe, you know. No, what I do is I usually say, that motherfucker just pissed me off, right? And I get mad and I get upset and I push back and I externalize. And so, you know, what we have to start to develop, or what we naturally, I should say not have to, but what naturally develops is more of an ability, what Anilayo was saying, for cognitive dissonance, of seeing the buildup of these underlying motives and reactions, and being able to start to be aware of those things, and then to practice an empathetic response to those. So this is all a little bit ambiguous because, and it's intentionally left that way because we all explore our own terrain for ourselves. No one can really say, oh, you do this in this situation, or you do that in that situation. We have to see our own patterns, our own motivations, our own reactions, and without judgment, and start to see, you know, how we want to respond. So investigating can be simple. Investigating through mindfulness can be really simple. It can be as simple as one of the noting practices that I use is, what is this? So whenever my attention may move somewhere, I may say, oh, what is this? It's it's that thought about that person at work, or, you know, okay, and then maybe I get more specific. It's a resentment, or it's a plan, or it's a memory, or whatever it is. What is this? How is this? So what? How is it affecting me? How does it sit? You know, not getting so lost in the language, but really being interested. How is it actually to have this resentment present in my mind right now? It's constricting. It's, you know, there's a little bit of pressure. There's some speed to it. There's not enough time. There's activation in the center of my body. You know, there's a tightening in my stomach. How is it? So what's the effect? What is this? How is this? And then what does it need? And what's more important here when investigating is asking the question than having the answer. So we're not trying to figure it all out right now in 30 minutes. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to monitor something, because if you follow something for long enough, it will reveal itself to you. It will show you its characteristics. It will show you how it affects you, and it will show you what it needs. And so this non-judgmental awareness is so important, especially when being mindful of the mind. So, the third foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of mind states or mental attitudes. One thing to be really aware of is that in the context of Buddhist practice, when we talk about the mind, we're actually talking about this term called citta. And what citta means is it means the interconnected quality of the heart and the mind. So the mind in the Buddhist context is not separate from your emotional response or intention, for that matter. So when we're talking about the being mindful of the mind, we're talking about the interrelatedness of our emotional life, of our moods, of our attitudes, and of our thought content. All of these things are included. And what we're doing is we're not trying, the Buddha never really set out to try to define the mind like we would try to do in science nowadays. He never really was interested in you know, having proof of a definition of something or trying to map it out exactly. But what he was trying to do is trying to create a practical framework to direct your attention to certain themes. And these themes are all interested in two things: what causes suffering and what leads to its end. And so the themes that we're looking at in the mind are more important than what the mind is, or, you know, is this an emotion, or is this a mood, or is this a, what's a mood, and what's an attitude, and what's an attitude, and what's a thought, and all of that. It's all interconnected. So these themes in the discourse, I kind of reworded some of this. The themes that we're looking at are a few. Traditionally, you could say that there are really three. The three, the you'll see on the back of Mikey's hoodie or my hoodie, it says meditate and destroy. And people ask me about this all the time. What are you destroying when you meditate? And what we're destroying are the defilements or the mind states of greed, hatred, and delusion. And so these are traditional, but it's important to break this down a little bit because for a lot of reasons. So I like to use a spectrum in looking at these three categories. So greed's not just one thing. That's a big word, right? What does that mean? It's a very intense word, too. It sounds very bad, right? And so what do we mean by a greedy mind? And what do we mean by a mind with hate? And what do we mean with a mind of delusion? And so this is my rewording of the Buddha's teaching. He says, in practicing mindfulness of the mind, one knows a lustful, greedy, or craving mind to be lustful, greedy, or craving. So this is greed. And a mind without lust, greed, or craving to be without lust, greed, or craving. One knows an aversive, resentful, or mind filled with ill will to be a mind of aversion, resentment, or ill will. And a mind without aversion, resentment, or ill will to be without aversion, resentment, or ill will. One knows a deluded mind to be deluded, and a mind without delusion to be without delusion. One also knows the presence or absence of a contracted mind, and one knows the presence or absence of a distracted mind. So the Buddha's discourses, if you read through them, they're very repetitive. This was an oral tradition for hundreds of years, and so he really wanted to kind of get his point across. So one knows a greedy mind is a greedy mind, and one knows a mind without greed to have no greed in it, you know, and same with hatred and delusion. And then he goes on to talk about contracted and distracted. and goes on even further from that. But the primary thing that we're doing is we're trying to emphasize bringing a particular attention to unwholesome or unskillful roots of the mind. And when we talk about unwholesome or unskillful, traditionally we would call these defilements, or in Pali Sanskrit they're called kalesas. And these are greed, hatred, and delusion traditionally. But I think it's important to look at what we're talking about when we say defilement. Defilement is, by definition, something that pollutes, corrupts, covers, or spoils the beauty and purity of something or someone. And so in one sense, we need to be really careful here when we talk about defilements in our mind or unskillful or unwholesome states, because we tend to very quickly throttle to a moralistic view of this, right and wrong. You know, I shouldn't be angry, I shouldn't be greedy, I shouldn't have delusion or self-obsession or self-centeredness in the mind. Joseph Goldstein says, although discerning skillful from unskillful is a basic practice in the Buddhist teaching, in our Western culture, it's a very delicate process. For many people, it's an easy step from recognizing a particular mind state like greed or hatred as being unwholesome to the feeling that you're a bad person for having it, or that somehow it's wrong for the mind state to even arise. This pattern of reaction simply leads to more self-judgment, more aversion, and more suffering. He says it's not a helpful cycle, right? And so I like to look at defilement in another definition. Sometimes it's described as something called, it's very synonymous with the word fortification that you would use in a military setting to fortify something. And fortification is the action of building a defensive wall or other reinforcement to strengthen a place against attack. So defilements actually serve us or have served us a purpose. When we feel threatened or we feel attacked or we feel separate from others, we feel like we may run out of something or there maybe isn't enough or so on and so forth, the greed arises to try to protect and try to defend against the running out, or to try to protect us from being harmed through hatred, through resentment. These are all defenses, and so it's not personal. They serve purposes at times, but overall, if they let take root in the mind, they lead towards greedy, hateful, and delusional actions, right? The Buddha said, whatever one thinks and ponders upon becomes the inclination of the mind. And so we need to be really careful about how much we feed certain states of mind, because they develop into patterns. And mostly they develop into silent patterns that we never talk about because they all exist in our minds. You know, no one wants to go around saying like, oh wow, in my mind I totally murdered that person in the car next to me on my way to work, right? But that is a part of the mind, right? It's a tendency of the mind. And so we want to be realistic. Looking at the spectrum, greed, hatred, and delusion, I like to break it down like this, because, you know, when you look at greed, it can be anything from as simple, and I love doing this in meditation practice, like looking at the tendency of my mind to anticipate what's next. You know, the very subtle. The mind doesn't so much, it gets really bored, you know. It doesn't really so much like just hanging out with the breath. You know, it really likes to think about what I'm going to have for dinner when I leave here, or if I have enough ice cream in the fridge, or, you know, it's payday tomorrow, or how, you know, or whatever it may be. So it tends to kind of anticipate or lean into the next thing. Leaning into the next. That's one way that I like to look at greed. You know, and then this can be waiting for something to happen, and so that kind of like impatience or irritability, that greedy sense of just kind of like, you know, and when anticipation gets turned up to a 10 a little bit, and it's like, okay, when is it going to happen? When is it going to happen? It's that opening Christmas presents kind of feeling, right? It's like, come on already, let's get it over with, that type of anticipation. And then it can be full-blown craving. Cravings distinguish in Buddhist practice from desire. Desire, completely wholesome. You desire to do some things, you have some goals, some aspirations, totally good. you would be a amoeba, right, just floating around if you didn't have any purpose or goals or aspirations. But craving is the demanding the satisfaction of our desires. It's the I have to. It's the impulsive, compulsive, you know, part of our system that just demands that something happens. And then, of course, when we get something, you know, or have even a thought, there's a tendency to cling to a pleasant thought or to cling to a pleasant experience and to really dig our claws into it. And so you can start to observe those states of mind, those qualities of greed in the mind. How does greed manifest from moment to moment without judging it and saying this is bad or wrong, but being really interested? Oh, wow, that's wild, you know, that that's happening. What is that? You know, how does that affect me? And what does that need? What's the response? Hatred, this can be subtle aversion, just kind of annoyance, you know, it can turn into irritability, it can move to hatred, full-blown, I hate this, you know, or even ill will, hatred turned almost into action, or like vengeance, vengeful action, it can manifest as resentment. I noticed this was an amazing thing that my mind would do when I was on a month-long silent meditation retreat, is it would just pull up people that it hated and just start picking them apart and assassinating. I was like 2 weeks into a meditation retreat. I hadn't talked to anyone. I'm sitting with a Buddhist monk and my mind's just like, oh, it's a good idea to just destroy this person right now and to think about what you're going to say next time you see him, right? And I'm just feeling the hatred, like, and then it just like anger comes online, right? And that's not so helpful. It's one of those things where it's like, okay, so don't judge that and see that and notice that. But also, it's completely skillful to sometimes be like, dude, no, not doing that, right? And so the spectrum of hatred. Delusion by its very nature is the most difficult mind state to recognize, right? Because it's delusion. We don't recognize it. Delusion's an interesting word. Sometimes it's like ignorance. And I actually like the word ignorance. I think of it as like ignorance. So it's the part, it's the state of mind that ignores that there are certain things that maybe are challenging or difficult or things that I don't want to look at or things that I don't want to confront or things that I don't want to engage in. And so delusion is a very subtle. You know, if there's one thing I can say about delusion from my own experience, don't underestimate the power and how much delusion there is in the mind, right? I'm still, like, baffled when I meditate with all of just the fantasy, you know, and the stories of the mind and all. It just loves to do that, you know? There's so much narrative. There's so much story. Sometimes I experience delusion as a checked out. So delusion can even manifest sometimes as sleepiness for me. It's like a kind of lethargy or a sense of a lack of energy. It's kind of like the, you know, when I check out and all I want to do is, you know, eat pizza and sit on the couch. And then there's some, it's not that that's bad, right? But that there's a fine line there between, you know, just vegging out and having some good old-fashioned, like, downtime. And then the, like, I don't actually want to deal with something, and so I'm checking out from it. There's simple fantasy. Delusion's a very wide category. All of the comparing mind, right, is that, you know, it's the part of the mind where I can walk in a room and, like, it automatically puts everyone in a hierarchy of where I belong in the social system. It's like, oh, I'm way cooler than that person and that person and that person, you know, but that, I really want that person to be my friend, or I really want to get, you know, it's that whole comparing, it's the self-obsession. All of the stories of myself and who I am and how I am and, you know, all of that. So who says that's who you are and how you are? You've got proof of that? No, my mind just loves to come up with all sorts of really wild proof for how I'm doing, you know. So couple more quick things. First of all, we look at the presence and absence of mind states. This is such an amazing and subtle part of this discourse I just read, is the Buddha's not just saying to know when one of these mind states is present, but he also is saying to notice when they're absent. Much more difficult to say, you know, especially when we experience intense emotion, for example, like anger. You know, I never walk around and say, wow, I'm really not angry right now, right? That's not a conscious thought that ordinarily arises in my mind. I know when I am angry, but it's more rare to acknowledge the absence of a mind state. And so sometimes I'll even you for yourself, you can sit and reflect, like, think about all of the mind states that you're not right now. You might be bored, right? You might be a little greedy or thinking about what's going to happen later or whatever. But, like, you know, when I think about for myself all the depression I've experienced and all of the, you know, internal suffering that I've experienced and, you know, the craving of, like, when I was in active addiction, like, those mind states are not present in the same way they were, you know, right now. And it can be a real big, you know, shift in perspective. Mindfulness is interested in the whole story. You know, we tend to have this negativity bias, they call this in neuroscience, so we tend to hyper-focus on the things that we don't like, or the things that are uncomfortable, or the things that really create dis-ease or discomfort. But mindfulness is something unpleasant may be present, but also there's more story here. There's also a lot of neutral experience here. There's also maybe even some pleasant parts of what you're experiencing. And can you be open, and can you open your awareness enough to see the whole picture? It's not exclusive, so we're not looking at one part to exclude another. We're looking at one part to include all. Also, what I'm not going to touch on, because this could be a 3-hour talk if I talked about, that he includes interest in restlessness and worry, which is one category, which means a distracted mind, and is interested in something called sloth and torpor, which is sleepiness or this kind of checked out sense. So there's more of a distinction there. And he goes on to talk about concentrated states of mind, that when we practice meditation, I think it's like great versus narrow, or surpassable versus unsurpassable, or a liberated mind or a non-liberated mind, which are, again, very interesting words. But when you break them down, they're more, you can kind of see a little clearer what those things mean. Simple practice, like we did tonight, around noticing mind states is there any part of my experience that's waiting for something to happen or wanting? So that's the first category, greed. Waiting for something to happen or wanting. Is there any part of my experience that's waiting for something to go away or not wanting? It's hatred or aversion. And then is there any part of my experience, or really asking myself the question, am I checked in? Am I here? Where am I if I'm not here? And not with judgment, but just noticing, where are you if you're not here? Oh, I was in this really weird, trippy dream thought that just came up and took me away for 3 minutes, you know? Okay, I'm not here, I'm gonna come back here, right? Okay, there's wanting, I'm gonna see if I can meet that with some, you know, let some of that go, let some of that be, meet that with some compassion, some patience, and some tolerance, and investigate it, and stay with it. Okay, there's some not wanting, some aversion, can I meet that with some compassion, with some empathy, some tolerance, some patience? Subtle practice, once you develop more of a practice around noting mind states and mental attitudes, you can start to notice the flavors of the mind. So these include moods. Something that is very hard for me to tune into, but has really been one of the most noticeable benefits of my meditation practice, is noticing when the mind has some type of mood. It's the lens that colors the experience. You know, I had to pee really bad the other day when I was doing this group, and I was late a little bit, and I was running in trying to set up, and there were, you know, I work in treatment centers, and I work with you know, people in the mental health field, and so there are people coming into the group, and I realized that I really, like, you know, because I was under some distress and aversion, I didn't want to interact with the patients, I didn't even want to say hi, and I wanted, you know, and I wanted to hurry up and go to the bathroom or whatever, but I had to set this stuff down. And so I was able just to kind of notice, oh, my mood, I'm very irritable right now. And being able to just notice that, it, you know, it was like, oh, okay, cool. Like, how do I want to respond from that irritability? It's not going to go away right this second, but how do I want to take responsibility for that and have the ability to respond? Talking about moods, Ajahn Chah says, within itself, the mind is already peaceful. That the mind is not peaceful these days is because it follows moods. It becomes agitated because moods deceive it. The untrained mind is stupid. Sense impressions come and trick it into unhappiness, suffering, gladness, and sorrow. But the mind's true nature is none of these things. Gladness or sadness is not the mind, but only a mood coming to deceive us. The untrained mind gets lost and follows these things. It forgets itself. Then we think that it is we who are upset or at ease or whatever. But really, this mind of ours is already unmoving and peaceful. Really peaceful. So we must train the mind to know these sense impressions and not get lost in them. Just this is the aim of all this difficult practice we put ourselves through. The last thing I'll say before I open it up is we also can start to use thinking as reflective practices. Death contemplation is a reflective practice through Buddhism that looks at the urgency and the reality of the impermanence of our lives. You know, so we actually start to use thinking to bring forward this ground, as we talked earlier, not just of the present, but the ground of the Dharma or some of the teachings that we actually contemplate. It's a contemplative practice that we're in. So we want to bring things intentionally to mind. And we want to practice mostly just mindfulness in everyday interactions. You know, looking at how our mind states and our moods, our attitudes, they constantly are changing. We're not going to ever be able to have one. I wish I could just have the happy state or the joyous state. Right? I'm almost a little bit sad and embarrassed to admit how infrequent that one visits, right? But, you know, the mind states are impersonal, like Ajahn Chah says here. What we're looking for is more equanimity, which is a balanced mind, which isn't just joy, or it's not just sadness, or it's not just this or that or the other. It's a mind that has the capacity to hold the other states of mind that can come and rise through it. I'll close with a quote by Sayadaw Tejaniya. He says that one thing you need to remember and understand is that you cannot leave the mind alone. It needs to be watched constantly. If you do not look after your garden, it will overgrow with weeds. If you do not watch your mind, defilements will grow and multiply. The mind does not belong to you, but you're responsible for it. So I want to open it up, typically how we do it here at Against the Stream.